From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Well, the planet just experienced its warmest August on record, according to both NOAA and NASA. In addition, this past summer is the warmest on record, and 2015 is set to become the warmest year ever, surpassing the old record, which was just set last year.
Last year! Jeez, and joining us to discuss the planet's ongoing fever and what this past summer was like closer to home will be Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service out of Salt Lake City.
He'll review the local trends in temperature and precipitation this past summer and talk about how the record El Niño now formed in the eastern Pacific will, or will not, impact our weather in the next few months.
All right. Then in the second half of the show, Judy Dorsey, president of the Brendel Group, joins us to discuss how businesses and municipalities incorporate concepts of sustainability into their daily practices.
What are sustainable acts and practices, and how do they reduce a company's environmental impact while improving their financial bottom line?
And what is greenwashing?
One of our favorite topics.
Yeah, and which companies employ that, and how do you recognize it? We'll learn about that. We're talking with Judy Dorsey of Brendel Group in the second half of the show.
You can join in on today's conversation by posting to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
This is Robin Marouche, director of the Kimball Arts Center, on behalf of Vail Resorts Epic Promise, proudly supporting KPCW. With a grant from Epic Promise, the Kimball Arts Center has provided over 7,500 students and almost 30 schools with free visual arts education. Thank you, Epic Promise, for giving our students an opportunity to learn about the arts and create their own masterpieces.
I'm Tim Henney.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Join us Wednesday at 9 a.m. for The Mountain Life.
We'll speak with Elizabeth Gilbert, author of Eat, Pray, Love, about her new book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear.
Then we'll talk about micro shelters, 59 creative cabins, and other small structures.
That's Wednesday at 9 a.m. on The Mountain Life. Brought to you by the doctors at the Park City Specialty Clinic,
Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank,
Park Meadows Country Club,
and Alpine Apothecary.
Exactly. There you go. There, welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues. I'm Chris Cherniak, Nell Larson across the board. We're here to talk about weather and climate and sustainability this week and kick things off. Brian McInerney from the National Weather Service is here with us. He joins us every equinox and solstice during the course of the year. And fall just happened a few days ago.
Yeah.
All of a sudden.
Maybe you wouldn't not necessarily know it, judging from some of the days we're having. Still a bit warm, and we'll talk about that in a couple minutes. But first, Brian, let's run through the summer, how the summer kind of unfolded. And in National Weather Service always considers summer as June, July, August.
Yeah.
Right? They just kind of, rather than trying to go by seasons, they just say June, summer, July, August. September is part of fall, as far as your record date keeping goes. So how did the summer unfold first temperature-wise?
So if you look at June was the hottest we've ever had. It was a record.
Really?
Yeah. It was quite warm during that entire time. And then July and August, really, temperature-wise, have not been that warm. It was warmer than normal, but not any record territory.
Nothing out of the ordinary, like past years. In fact, not even many days above 100 degrees down in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think if you were even in Park City, you would think June was the hottest period. That's what you felt. And then July and August really weren't too bad.
I ran some numbers on June for a local weather station, and it pretty much June averaged around 80 degrees here in Park City.
Yeah,
you know, and that average just, daily temperature. And the average is usually around 76 or 77. So pretty healthy difference
there. It followed the trend that we saw all winter long. We were breaking heat records continually all the way through the spring. And then into June. So it's been following that trend where it's quite warm.
Okay. So and just to kind of follow along, you know, September has kind of say we're kind of average or still a little bit of a warm spell?
Yeah, we're a little bit warmer. What we've had, though, are some tropical systems that have moved up, bringing cool, moist air into Utah, and that's cooled things down, which has been nice.
Okay.
Yeah, we just haven't had that big high pressure that's just been parked over us. It's actually had some pretty good rainfall and bringing cooler temperatures with that.
So feeling the remnants of tropical air all the way up here in northern Utah.
Yeah.
That's great or interesting.
Yeah.
So, all right, well, then that segues to precipitation. How was the summer with respect to rainfall? Usually I see we average around a little like 3.5 inches of rainfall.
Yeah, and the rainfall this summer has come in the form of very intense thunderstorms. Mm. We've had some periods during June where we had low-level moisture that came off of the Pacific as a result of those decaying hurricanes and decaying tropical systems. But it was predominantly in southern Utah, and we had flash flooding as a result of that, where we had long-duration, low-intensity rainfall that fell and produced flash flooding in widespread areas. Specifically down in southeastern Utah. And then July and August, we've had more of the same, where we had periodic flash flooding due to thunderstorms. We've had rainfall up here. So when you look at it above and below average, most of the state during July and August have been above average, with isolated pockets of up to 400% precipitation. But that's just due to thunderstorms producing an inch or two of rain. Mm. And in some instances, we've had an inch and a half of rain in 30 minutes, a 100-year event, which caused some pretty big floods in that one that produced all those fatalities.
Right.
So talk a little bit about how those isolated storms have impacted the flooding, especially in the narrow canyons.
So what happens is, if you've ever been in a slot canyon, they are very narrow. There's an absence of vegetation in the areas upstream and all around them. And the rocks are impervious to infiltration. So now you take all that, you tip it up, and then have it all drain right down into this really narrow drain called a slot canyon that people like to canyoneer in. And when we take, for example, the flood that we had last Monday in Zion National Park, the people went into Keyhole Canyon, and it's so narrow, and you have rain upstream of an inch to 2 inches. The North Fork of the Virgin River went to 2,200 CFS from 40 CFS. The East Fork of the Virgin River, which flows through Zion National Park, went to 2,600 CFS. And now you've got that same amount of rain falling over a canyon that you can spread your arms out and touch both sides, and it's above you, and there's no escape, and those poor people were stuck.
40 to 2,200 CFS over obviously a very short period of time.
Within an hour's time.
Holy mackerel.
So you really have a wall of water coming at you.
Yeah. And sometimes it may not even be raining where they are.
Yeah.
So it could still be blue skies or partly cloudy. It looks okay. But yet, you know, like you say, it could rain. The thunderstorm could be a couple miles away. They may even hear it in the distance and maybe making plans to get out. But it's still not time enough.
And then if we go farther south, it was essentially the same thunderstorm complex that produced all these fatalities. In Hilldale, we had an inch and a half of rain in 30 minutes, which was a 100-year event, or a 1% chance of that occurring.
Right.
And it came actually in two waves. The first thunderstorm moved through, caused a flash flood. We had a warning out for that. And then a second thunderstorm moved through. And then that one was the one that really caused all the havoc and washed the cars with all the people in it downstream.
Right.
And then that moved up directly into Zion National Park. And then that killed the people in Zion National Park. And there was another fatality of a guy driving from Hurricane south on one of the roads down there who tried to cross a flooded wash, and he was swept away too. So it was a very violent event due to essentially one thunderstorm complex.
So with all of that in mind, how do you avoid getting yourself into these situations, you know, if you want to do canyoneering or check out one of these washes or slot canyons?
So the best thing you can do is to find out that morning what the potential for flash flooding is. What's the atmosphere look like? This atmosphere was moisture laden. We had really good dynamics. We had moderate flash flood potential out for that day, which indicated that if you were going into a slot canyon, you were at risk. And there was a good chance in some of these scarier areas that you were going to see flash flooding. We also had a flash flood warning probably for Zion about 2 hours before it happened as we were watching this thunderstorm complex move up. So there is information you really should get. Weather.gov is the place that we posted under flash flooding. You can see the potential. But to take people into those slot canyons, you really should be aware of what the potential for flash flooding is, because once you're in there, you really don't have cell coverage. You don't have any way to get information on what's happening upstream from you. And it's really a dangerous situation. If it's dry or we're not expecting any thunderstorms, then it's a really fun time to go rappelling down these cliffs and then get to the next level and hike a little bit and rappel some more. It's quite fun. But if there's a flash flood coming down that, it's horrific to be in there.
Well, do you recall what, when you posted the forecast for that day, what the percent for thunderstorms was forecast? You know, is it 30, 60, 80?
You know, I
don't. And the reason I ask that is that you guys, National Weather Service, only can post, obviously, the forecast and then a warning, in a sense. And you forward that to, let's say, to the National Park Service, who then have to make decisions about how to act on or how they post that information.
Yeah.
Right? You don't post it for the National Park Service. They take your information and then they decide to post it in some fashion.
Yeah.
Okay.
So our relationship with Zion and all the parks and the monuments is really quite good, because we learned a long time ago that there's a disconnect with the National Weather Service's text warnings. They only go so far. So we went down to the parks and said, here's who we are. Here's what you guys do. How can we do this better? And so what Zion does is stamp it on the back of your backcountry permit. They have the flash flood potential right there at the desk, and the rangers will try and dissuade you from going out into the backcountry.
And that's that. I guess that's what I'm driving at, is like, if you forecast a 70% chance of thunderstorms in the area, maybe the National Park Service needs to come up with a green, yellow, red type of alert system that says anything above this percentage chance, you're not allowed to go into these slot canyons or something, or do more of a job, more than just dissuade. Yeah. I don't know. That's a question for the National Park Service. But
they actually have just what you're saying.
Okay.
Kepler Reef, Grand Staircase, Escalante National Monument, and Zion, they all have what you're suggesting. It's in a graphic format. And once we issue a flash flood warning that is anywhere in the park, they shut down the backcountry desk. You can't get a permit to go in there while that flash flooding. And then 2 hours after that. But before that, the philosophy is it's not a Disney ride. There's risk to be taken, and that's the beauty of the Park Service. And really, I don't know if people want to be restricted, but you have to use good judgment. But people get killed in the Park Service all the time for just using poor judgment or being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. And in the unfortunate case in Hilldale, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. They weren't even trying to cross the wash, as I understand, the vehicles that got washed away. They got like surrounded and inundated as they were watching the flood.
Well, what happened in Hilldale is the kids and the moms were at a park, and that was upstream. And if you see the topography, the town is at 5,000 feet. The tops of the drainages are at 7,000 feet, and there's only, in the area they were in, it's probably only a couple of miles from the town to the top. And it's really steep. Vegetation is lacking. There is some vegetation, and it's impervious soil. So they had experienced, they were in the playground or in the park. They saw the flash flood coming. They tried to get down, and then they got stuck because they didn't want to drive across it.
Mm-hmm.
Then that flash flood subsided. They thought, okay, we're safe. They actually then moved and went across and then thought they were in a safe place. The second flash flood came in. It was huge. Mm-hmm. It was gigantic, bigger than what they expected. And it surrounded and hit them from the back and the sides and just picked up the cars like toys and just threw them downstream. Cut one car in half. That's how much force was exerted on these vehicles. And they just didn't expect that volume of water to come down on them. They had moved over, and they actually were making correct decisions, but they weren't expecting the magnitude of that second wave.
Municipalities have warning systems for tornadoes. They have warning systems for lightning.
Yeah.
Are there warning systems like that for flash floods? Is there a way of establishing upstream
when we send warning our systems? If you have a smartphone, if you go buy a smartphone today, it has a capability to receive flash flood alerts for flash flooding, tornadoes, all these different weather events. It will just chime on your phone, a different chime, and a message will pop up that you don't recognize. And we have those all over. And they actually got those messages that the flash flood warning is out. And they were aware of that. But there was some confusion over Colorado City and Hilldale are really the same town.
Yeah.
But they're split by the Utah-Arizona border. So the National Weather Service in Salt Lake, we issued one for Hilldale, but our area doesn't go across the border. and so there was some confusion. Where is the flash flood coming to? The second wave, then Las Vegas Weather Service, they issued their warning. So now we've got the whole town covered. But unfortunately, the people were aware of flash flooding, but they just didn't move. If they would have got out of their cars and started running up the hillside, they would have been okay, even walking.
Right.
But they were thinking they were parked in a safe place, and unfortunately, they weren't.
Okay. Tragic.
So
you mentioned the smartphones and the warnings. Is there a specific app that weather.gov has or NOAA or NASA? Or?
You know, they don't, and they should. I just heard the director of the Weather Service 2 months ago. I was in Alabama at the Water Center, and he said, we're not in the business of writing apps. And there was a lot of discussion on that. Why don't we? And it's the idea. It's a government agency. Mm-hmm. We're competing against the private sector. Let them make money on apps for our stuff. And there's always a problem with how much should the Weather Service put out? Are we in competition with the TV weather stations, you know, the right. guys that do the weather? And there's a valid argument that, but on the other hand, in my mind, I thought we should be having apps. We should keep pace with technology and social media and these things. And we were allowed to use Twitter, which was great, and Facebook, but we should now be doing apps. So you can put the app on your phone, it'll alert, but your phone will do it anyways. You don't really need the app to get a flash flood warning. So say right now, if the National Weather Service put a flash flood warning out for the area in Park City, all our phones would chime saying there's a flash flood warning coming with the information associated with it. And we should think of where to go. Should we move out of this area if we're in a low-lying area?
Or next step, go check the radar, the local weather radar, which everyone should be able to access on their phone and see where there is a storm. Because radars are within 5 minutes of real time.
Yeah, and they're wonderful apps. Yeah. You can get a really good feel for where things are coming toward you.
Okay. We're speaking with Brian McInerney with the National Weather Service, talking about obviously all things weather and climate. But overall, the precipitation thing, I was looking at the National Climatic Center website this morning, and it seems like the state is still pretty much in kind of a mild, moderate drought condition.
Yeah. And really that's due to our poor runoff from spring snowmelt runoff for the past 4 years.
Still affecting, still being impacted by
that. Our reservoirs are lower than they should be right now.
Hey, I was just going to ask, what's kind of the status on the reservoirs and the water supplies going into this fall?
So right now our water supply is in okay condition. It's not great. And that's due to a large part of last two summers, not including this summer. We had copious amounts of rain that people used to water their landscape as opposed to stored water. So we're now moving into water year 2016 starting on October 1st. And the big question we get asked is, what's the winter going to be like? And especially living in Park City, it's all about skiing and powder and all that good stuff.
Of course.
And typically when we're asked this, there really, really truly is there's very little skill in forecasting beyond 7 days. However, this year we are forecasting, or not we, but the climate people are forecasting a record-setting El Nino or a very strong El Nino condition. And El Nino occurs, when you look at the equatorial Pacific, the winds blow from the east consistently. They're the trade winds right across the equator from the east to the west toward Australia. And so what happens is the pool, the ocean, the sea surface temperatures, the warmer pool of water goes toward Australia. And it parks there. And that area then produces thunderstorms, a lot of heat, a lot of energy, and the atmosphere then circulates around these types of events. With El Nino, the warm pool then starts creeping back towards South America. And it can be a weak El Nino, and it doesn't really matter. This warm pool is really quite big, and it's going all the way to Ecuador. And then that warm pool is moving up Baja and then into in Southern California. Now you have this pool of really warm water, which produces a lot of evaporation, a lot of thunderstorms, and a lot of energy into the atmosphere. And what happens is the subtropical jet, the jet stream that comes down by Hawaii, gets stronger. And the high pressure that we've had over these past 4 years goes away. It just moves out of the way. So now you have a direct source. They call this sometimes the Pineapple Express. You have a direct jet stream that moves across the Pacific right into California. And California typically does quite well. For northern Utah, in a weak to moderate El Nino, there's really not a good signature because mm-hmm. we're between the Pacific Northwest and the Desert Southwest. The mm-hmm. Desert Southwest typically gets cooler and wetter. Pacific Northwest gets warmer and drier. Northern Utah is in the middle. A strong El Nino, if you look at the years, and the sample size is really quite small, is 1997, which was really a big year, mm-hmm. and 1983, which was the flood year we had, where water was going down Main Street or State Street, and we had all sorts of flooding. And then if you go back even farther, you see the biggest years have occurred when we've had a very strong El Nino.
It's now, not, like you say, Brian, it's not a one-to-one relationship right. at all. There could be some big El Nino years and nothing.
Right. But if you were going to wager, if you were going to go and say, what are the probabilities are higher that we're going to be wetter than normal. And typically, if you look at where the jet stream is, the latter part of the winter, that jet stream sags climatologically a little bit farther toward the equator and picks up more of that moisture. So the effects occur, the wetter weather, occur in later in the winter. And so that's something we see. 83 was a kind of a normal year yeah. until about March, and then it just kept going all the way, and it was about 6 weeks late melting, and then there was a switch that got flipped. The weather went from cool and wet to bright sunshine, and we produced all sorts of flooding. But I think around here, what we want to see is just continuous storm activity coming from the west and the southwest due to this very strong El Nino.
Okay. Now, whether that means more snow or just more precipitation, that's a separate question, right? Because that doesn't always guarantee there's going to be more snow. It's just more precipitation.
Right.
And so we'll find out. But now, if it sounds like these storms are coming up from the south, so does that mean it's a warmer storms?
Yeah, it's going to come from the west. Climatologically, these come from the west or the southwest. And most likely, we're going to get snow.
Okay.
We're not warm enough, so we'll see rain during the wintertime. But it is a yet.
Yet.
Give it time.
Give us another 20 to 30 years. But we will see snow. But these storms are really moisture-laden, and typically your snow isn't as light and fluffy like a 6% density that you see coming out of the Pacific Northwest. So powder conditions, a lot of snow, but maybe not as good of skiing. But still, we'll take what we can get, and hopefully we'll have a lot of snow.
Absolutely.
And I'm sorry, Brent, what day does this start again?
This will start
October.
Sometime October. Mid-October, we'll say. But really, we don't know.
Yes. You know, plus or minus.
Yeah, we're talking big picture. Overall conditions, when you're trying to pin down a date, we don't know.
No, and we see – actually, it was really interesting. Last week we had on a couple of arborists talking about some of the impacts associated with both wet, an extra wet mm-hmm. spring, which created an aspen-based fungus that has impacted a lot of the aspen in the area. And then drought conditions, which has impacted some of our spruce. Desiccating our spruce. So whether wet or dry can have serious impacts on our biosystems here.
Yeah. So what you want is close to the mean. You don't want extremes. And we've been getting extremes in temperature and precip. And when you look at the research on climate change, the literature, that's where we're headed to more extreme precip intensity and temperature ranges,
okay.
especially in the warmer sector.
Well, we got to wrap up here, but I had a shameless plug because Brian is helping out myself at the PC CAPS program at the high school. We have three students who are working on a climate analysis for Summit County area. And it's kind of taking on kind of an expansion of the existing Save Our Snow report that was now almost 6 years old. And so we're looking at 6 years more of data and seeing what the trends continue to show. Are things warming? When are they warming? Maybe what seasons might be a little warmer than others. So Brian has been very kind to mentor Jessica, Paige, and Sienna.
Great kids.
Over at the high school on this project, and we'll keep you updated on that. Thank you for doing that.
We'll want your results. Can we get Jessica and Sienna in here?
And Paige, absolutely. They're going to be here. That's part of their deliverable for their for their project.
Perfect.
For their CAS project. They're going to be here in December or so to give us a little summary of their project.
Pressure's on.
Yes. Yes, and I've named names. So, so Brian, again, thanks so much for joining us, as always. And of course, we'll see you in 3 months.
Yeah.
And see if the El Nino is really turned on.
Yeah.
And what it looks like.
Hopefully we'll be awash in snow at that point.
Okay.
That's right.
That's a deal.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Let's take a break for underwriters. And when we come back, Judy Dorsey of the Brendel Group.
There you go.
Slowly. It's This Green Earth.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
This is a voice from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch, winding down another growing season with KPCW. For the fall season, we stock a variety of winterizing necessities, including wildflower and grass seed, fertilizer and compost, bulbs and fall decorations. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We are on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our environment and our impacts upon the environment.
And connections with the environment.
Connections with, thank you, forget that. And concepts of sustainability. And for once, we're actually going to talk a little bit about sustainability, concepts thereof, with Judy Dorsey. She's the president of the Brendel Group, a environmental consulting firm out of Fort Collins, correct?
That's right.
With offices around the perhaps elsewhere or so. But Judy, thanks so much for joining us. We want to learn a little more about the concept of what sustainability means, how businesses and municipalities incorporate sustainable practices and acts. Mm-hmm. So give us a little background on the company first. When were you established?
Sure. Brendel Group was established in 1996. And I'm the president
right.
and principal engineer. We now have 20 people on our team, and we're growing. We were founded in Fort Collins. We have an office in Denver, and you may have heard we're actually looking to open an office in Utah.
In Utah,
And the reason that's exciting and maybe appropriate to talk about that today on this show is our first project outside of Colorado was for Park City 7 years ago, working with the municipality and the community stakeholders on the community greenhouse gas inventory and some of the strategies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions through the Save Our Snow effort.
So how about that?
Yeah,
I first met Nell.
That's right. Perfect. That's right. We were just talking about this. So before we dig into the details on that, is that project kind of indicative or representative of the other kinds of work that you do, or what are the specialties of the Brendel Group?
Well, we've completed 300 projects in the last 19 years for 150 customers across 30 states. Mm-hmm. And sustainability, while it has some framework and process and protocol, we're more of a boutique consulting, engineering, and planning firm. So we would like to think that every project served the unique needs of the customer. But that said, yes, it was somewhat related in that one of our major sectors is local government, and the Greenhouse Gas Inventory and Climate Action Plan is one of our service areas. We have service areas in energy, water, climate, mm-hmm. sustainability planning, and green building and design, serving local government, ski areas, ski towns, leading edge companies, and utilities.
Okay, so what are you doing when you do a greenhouse gas inventory?
So greenhouse gas inventory, in fact, in the day, so to speak, before we had protocol, we were watching and contributing to emerging protocol. But now today is pretty well established carbon accounting protocols for documenting the emissions associated with a community's buildings, building energy consumption, electricity and natural gas, transportation fuels, solid waste mostly, as well as emissions associated with wastewater treatment and other industrial processes within a community.
So basically accounting for the oil, coal, and natural gas that is consumed in the process of a municipality running its infrastructure.
Both the municipality running its infrastructure as well as community-wide, the residents and businesses, so their homes and businesses and tourism economy, ski areas, very major employers, et cetera. So it's typically the municipal operations actually only account for 2-3% of a community's greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay, and that's what you saw with Park City?
Park City and across all the inventories we've done throughout the U.S. Yeah.
Okay.
So you mentioned a specific niche working with ski towns and mm-hmm. ski resorts. So you've obviously worked with Park City and Summit County. What other areas around the West have you done similar projects for?
For ski areas.
In the ski area.
So our work with ski areas is twofold. One is with the National Ski Areas Association out of Lakewood, Colorado. It's a trade association of their member ski areas, helping them implement their sustainable slopes program. And then the other is direct sustainability consulting to ski areas mostly throughout Colorado. In Utah, we've actually supported Stevens Pass in Washington and a few others. Mm-hmm. But so a handful throughout the U.S.
And do you see that as a growing trend? Or is the ski industry as a whole kind of jumping on this bandwagon, I guess, seeing, you know, what the impacts of climate change might be to them? Or is it still a pretty small handful of resorts?
No, actually, it's really interesting. And today is a great day. You mentioned the equinox. This is also today is the release of the annual sustainability slopes report for the National Ski Areas Association. So interested listeners can go to nsaa.org. and pulled on that report. It's the 15th year. So the Sustainable Slopes Environmental Charter was commissioned in the year 2000. It has 21 principles. So if you think of, like, say, for communities, frameworks such as ICLEI STAR, or for higher ed institutions, sustainability frameworks like their STARS program, the ski industry actually was a leader. It had an environmental charter and framework since the year 2000. They had 215 ski areas endorsed the charter, and annual reporting and progress of results to that. So some really interesting, you know, impact results over time with regard to implementation by ski areas, with regard to all aspects of sustainability, but most importantly, climate change.
Right. And to be honest, ski areas have a real large carbon footprint. They are just a form of recreation or a type of industry that consumes a lot of energy, whether directly, you know, running chairs and running equipment and grooming equipment and all their services, or indirectly, of course, because the majority of the people who come here to ski or go to a resort are consuming fossil fuels too. So they have a large carbon footprint. So basically they have a lot of opportunity to reduce that carbon footprint. And that's where you guys come in.
What a good way to look at that.
Yeah,
right.
Well, that's what you guys do. You inventory that. Here's where you're consuming. Here's where your carbon footprint is very large. And then let's talk about some of the things you can do to reduce that.
It's true. They do have a large carbon footprint. However, we've had some really interesting results about the actual carbon footprint of ski areas following protocol. By the way, the first company in the United States to have their greenhouse gas inventory certified through the climate registry was a ski area. It was Grand Targhee. And so the like leadership has been there for some time. So using recognized protocol, the National Ski Areas Association, in partnership with Brenner Group, created a greenhouse gas inventory tool. 35 ski areas have now joined the Climate Challenge and are annually conducting a greenhouse gas inventory and publicly reporting that. The total combined footprint of all 35 ski areas just released today, 191,400 metric tons per year of greenhouse gas emissions. Sounds high, right? It's one-tenth of the Summit County greenhouse gas emissions inventory recently released. It's a it's when we look at that, that total is about the size of what we would see in a university or small city. Typical urban areas, city of Fort Collins, where I'm from, greenhouse gas emissions, 2.3 million metric tons at annually. So it's I like to say that, yes, there's a lot of opportunity, but their contribution is actually relatively disproportionate to their vulnerability to changing climate, the topic of your earlier part of today. So now there are steps being taken around advocacy to increase the impact because they have such a great sounding pad for education, advocacy, legislative affairs issues, et cetera.
So in addition with working with these resorts on their sustainability and their actions, are you working at all with them on climate adaptation, on facing the changes that we expect to see in the future?
That's a great question. To us, climate adaptation is emerging protocol on how to support our business customers as well as local government to adapt to a changing climate. And in some ways, in the sustainability movement, we didn't want to almost acknowledge adaptations necessary because does it let up the urgency around mitigation? That said, that we, as you just heard, we have a changing climate. And so one of the things that we've been working on is adaptation with our customers. And this year, Brendel Group created a competitive grant through the National Ski Areas Association for ski areas to apply to win a grant for us to work with them on an adaptation plan and applying the principles of net zero water. So a Utah ski area, Alta Ski Area, won that grant. And so we are working this year with Alta Ski Area on adaptation. It was also the topic of two major programs by the National Ski Areas Association at their winter trade shows and annual conference. So yes, great question. It's definitely just coming on the scene.
Getting sort of on the radar screen for these groups.
We're speaking with Judy Dorsey. She is the president and founder of the Brendel Group, a environmental consulting firm out of Fort Collins, Colorado, that specializes in sustainability management plans, greenhouse gas inventories, carbon footprinting. So, Judy, I worked for an environmental consulting firm, and when I was in Florida, we attempted to go out and market sustainability plans and carbon footprinting to local municipalities and other businesses. And here's the kind of the response that we would get. It typically came in one or more of the following. The first response was, well, what's my return on investment, right? Why should I give you guys a dollar in consulting fees when perhaps maybe 3 or 4 years down the road I might see a return on in that in the form of savings on energy, right? So they have to basically run the numbers there. The second one was always like, well, we're already doing this. You know, we would tell them what, you know, what sustainable management is. And they said, well, we're doing this. You know, we print on both sides of the paper and we have a hybrid parking spot out front. So we're all over this. Thanks for coming in. You know, and not understanding that there's a much wider universe of opportunities to reduce their footprint. And the third one was interesting because it was more regulation-based. So many municipalities and private industry are used to employing environmental policies and protocols because the regulations say they have to, whether it's local, state, or federal. And so they would say, like, well, what are the? Why would I want to do this? There's no regulation that says I have to, again, spend money at the end of the day to be a more sustainable company. So I don't know. I was just kind of curious whether you've confronted those kind of attitudes or if they've changed over time and businesses and municipalities are seeing better understanding the value of sustainable practices?
Right. No, it's a great question. We've absolutely experienced all four of those responses over time. I would say in our 19 years, we described that the first 10 were about persuasion.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't until possibly even the Recovery Act where there was a lot more infusion of capital to help address these issues that people started to follow the money and open their eyes towards what sustainability could do.
Yeah.
But that said, we still get that occasionally to the question of we're already doing this. We might say, well, low-hanging fruit grows back. When was the last time you did a comprehensive assessment of your opportunity? And have you taken a strategic approach to capacity building to sustain this level of progress over time? Then with regard to that regulatory environment, it depends if our customers being local government or leading edge companies, especially if those companies have a consumer base like ski areas, of course, they're motivated beyond their what they're legally obligated to do.
Right.
And so, yeah, each of those have a little bit different answers, but we've certainly experienced it. I feel your pain.
Yeah.
And I'd like to say things are getting better, but it's still constantly an issue. But to this point about the economic and business case, also last year, I keep talking about the ski industry today, I guess, because I'm sitting here in beautiful Park City.
Right.
And today's the release of the NSAA report, but all of these translate to the other sectors that we serve. We did a study that was released last year on the economic benefits of sustainability to the ski industry, and we said, and this was more to address the boardroom and the ski area owners than the mountain managers and other staff, is to say, hey, if you implement all of these various lighting upgrades or snowmaking efficiency, other practices, is that enough to even register when you aggregate all of that to the balance sheet and income statement levels?
Mm-hmm.
And the fluctuations that you might see with regard to sustainability, how does that compare to the economic fluctuations you would otherwise naturally see due to snowfall or skier visits? And we were actually able to show a measurable impact on profit from a comprehensive approach to sustainability, employing, as long as you're comprehensive and not just shotgun approach and you are aggregating those benefits, you can actually improve the financial performance and therefore, of course, the valuation and other indicators for your business, ski areas included.
So it's worth hiring you. You can pay for – they can absorb your fees and still save money. I mean, that's the point of a good consultant.
That we hope so, and we include our fees when we show payback and ROI, so that even including the cost of services, that the ROI is.
Yeah. Okay. So you're doing work for Summit County.
Yes.
And Lisa Yoder, she's sustainability coordinator, so you're assisting her with their greenhouse gas inventory and identifying, again, you're identifying opportunities to improve the efficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, Summit County's municipal infrastructure on how they consume fossil fuels in one form or another, or how much waste they generate, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you see some of Summit County's opportunities?
Summit County has great opportunities, and that is to build on the momentum of its success so far.
Yeah.
And I have to really commend the Summit County Power Works efforts. And it feels like Summit County has kind of gotten at something that other communities in the American West have had a really, really hard time doing, which is addressing growth at the same time as climate change reductions. And so, it harkens back to a long-term commitment, sustained effort, a highly engaged, educated community. We would love to, Chris and Mel, to have you guys come to our community and do a radio show weekly, because you should never underestimate the capacity building and impact of an informed constituency that really does help consultants work, make it a lot easier as we're working in communities, being able to identify those opportunities. So the opportunities are in, you know, transportation, building energy efficiency, renewable energy.
Water conservation is part of that.
Solid waste management. So those are the opportunities, but to me, the real opportunities are what's unique about Summit County and the extent that it's been able to sustain put forth a sustained effort over time and show some measurable results even in the face of growth.
Okay.
So in conjunction with the county, you recently released kind of an action plan. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that and what that entails.
Yeah. So the action plan has a different, well, first I should just say it addresses what the emissions are, and 1,400,000 tons of annual greenhouse gas emissions. The planning process looked at measuring the impact of all the efforts so far and doing a forecast of how emissions might increase based on the growth we just described.
Right.
And then working with stakeholders, including some of you and others in the community, to determine what's a reasonable goal that is achievable yet ambitious and will make a difference. And so the goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We called it 15% by 2050, in the next 15
years.
By 2015.
Tight timeline there.
15 by 2030.
Right away. Right. And then from there, that goal has supporting strategies. We discussed earlier the building energy efficiency, but we also try to look at like catalyzing efforts and building off of the Summit County Power Works.
Right.
As well as, you know, some of those things we discuss, catalytic efforts around education and I would call them more system levers than just the what of how to get to greenhouse gas emissions reduction, but more the system levers and how communities work in order to be mobilizing efforts for homeowners and businesses.
Well, let's talk about some other communities. Mm-hmm. I mean, Fort Collins have programs in place. You you work with other municipalities like that?
Fort Collins just had a historic vote that unanimously passed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80%. 80%. Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
By when?
2030.
Wait a minute. 80% by 2030?
Yes.
And we're okay.
And we're doing 15. They're putting us to shame.
Yeah, but we don't know what their baseline is now.
Yeah,
it's huge. It's unbelievable. Really? So 80%. So what are they going to do to get to that?
Okay. Well, there are a number of things. One, I should note that their first greenhouse gas inventory was in 1999, and that they've had two updates to their climate action plan. There were some kind of ambitious, larger initiatives that came forth with this goal setting, including some models around what's called utility as a service provider. Fort Collins has its own municipal utility, so they're looking at more of a turnkey effort where homeowners would opt out instead of opting in to having home energy retrofits, and then they could opt into different scales. And it's on-bill financed, and there are other mechanisms that are really getting at how to finance and remove barriers at scale. That's one example. Also, Fort Collins Utilities is a municipal utility. It's one of four municipal utilities that are owned by Platte River Power Authority, so they have some opportunity around utility-scale renewables that other communities we support don't have.
Right.
So there were some levers that they had that were a little bit more.
So although it's a very ambitious number, they have the structure in place to perhaps shoot for that, actually reach that 80%. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I remember in the early conversations about, you know, what can we do here in Park City and Summit County, that kept coming back around. Would a municipal utility be doable or feasible here? Because it gives you so much more power around your decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Has that discussion continued? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the next closest thing we're seeing in California for some of the communities that we're serving, we're working with Hermosa Beach on carbon neutrality, is around community choice aggregation, which is sort of a hybrid model of where you can still choose the electric, the source of your electric power, but it's more, it's not a true municipalization, but a hybrid model that's passed in California.
Okay.
Interesting.
All right. Hey, well, lots more questions. A really interesting discussion. And Judy, I tell you what, before Nell and I take this green earth to Fort Collins, we'll let the Brendel Group and your staff, because I'm sure they have lots of extra time, actually set up their own radio show. We'll help you.
Okay.
How about you guys take the shot, then we'll come to Fort Collins. Judy Dorsey is the president of the Brendel Group, a sustainability consulting firm out of Fort Collins. And again, we want to thank you so much. Where can people go to learn more about the Brendel Group?
Yes, we're at brendelgroup.com. And if I could say, this is September is Net Zero Water Month. So go to brendelgroup.com and learn more about Net Zero Water.
Net Zero Water. Real quick, how does that happen?
It's planning within the resources available now in the face of a changing climate.
Right.
So
God knows we know that.
Sounds like a conversation for,
figuring out
the show.
It's not, it's more than just relying on El Nino. Let's put it that.
Right. And it's more than designing to what you think your project needs instead of what's available at your project.
Okay. Perfect.
Got it.
Judy Dorsey, again, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
All right. Let's take one more break for some underwriters and we'll be back. We got a couple of calendar event items. It's the screener. Stay tuned.
Rocky Mountain Power proudly supports KPCW and This Green Earth. Your old fridge or freezer could be wasting energy and money. Rocky Mountain Power will pick up your old appliance for proper recycling. 95% of the components will be reused. Pickup information at WattSmart.com.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage service and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Help keep Summit County Recycling clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Hideout Canyon, Master Plan Community on the Lake, info at hideoutcanyon.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
It's This Green Earth. We got a few minutes. I have a couple calendar of event items. One, there is a film this Thursday, September 24th, 7 o'clock, at the Jordan Commons in Sandy. The film is called Plant Pure Nation. This film will give you a great perspective of the science behind the whole food, plant-only diet and lifestyle while focusing on the political battle that's being waged to keep this life-saving information away from the public to protect the standard industry, the status quo. So it's called Plant Pure Nation, and it's down in Sandy this Thursday, 7 o'clock at Jordan Commons. And Kent Mora, he's a Park City local, is hosting the event. And you can learn more about the event and what Kent is doing by going to onesingleact.com.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And actually, another one is real quick. There is an environmental humanities symposium starting also this Thursday, the 24th, and goes to the 27th down at the U. But it also includes some talks at BYU too. It's free and open to the public. The symposium is titled "The Future of the Environmental Humanities: Art, Thought, and Action in the Anthropocene," and it's really a series of talks. You can learn more by going to the Environmental Humanities Department at the U of U and learn more about the talks they're bringing. I'm going to try to get down there Friday and listen in. So it's really – Environmental Humanities is a growing field, and it's an important field.
And still a relatively new department at the U who's doing all kinds of neat stuff this.
Yeah. So I recommend that event too.
Well, before we wrap up, we have to mention that the Mountain Life Tomorrow with Tim and Lynn will be speaking to Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, Love, about her new book entitled Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. So she'll be on tomorrow morning between 9 and 10 a.m.
Really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
And they'll be speaking to somebody about kind of – Not even tiny homes, like micro shelters.
Smaller than tiny homes?
We'll have to listen in to find out.
The tiny home.
The tiniest tiny home you can. Creative shelters, I think.
Yeah. More tiny. Okay. That's good. That's all in the mountain life.
Nano shelter.
Well, we got to wrap. Yeah. We have to wrap up. Let's thank our underwriters, who include
Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Vail Resorts,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
and San Francisco Design. You can also join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth. This is KPCW 91.9 FM Park City. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.